All right, we ended yesterday talking about the Alexamenos Graffito, which is inside of the guard room on the Palatine Hill, dating from around the 1st to the 3rd century. And you see it as a mocking, in some sense, of the Christian belief in the crucified king, or in the crucified God, Jesus. So you have Alexamenos raising up his hand, and at the bottom it says Alexamenos worships his God in a mocking fashion. This is going to kind of be a segue into some of more of the challenges of the canonical Gospels. Challenges come from, we're going to look at it really from two primary categories. We're going to see direct challenges, and we're not going to go through all of them, but we're still kind of using the challenges to develop historically some things we can affirm or develop or understand more clearly from the Gospels. But you'll see it from external agents, and then at times you'll also see it from more of the non-canonical Gospels. But I'm going to argue that even though these are primarily seen as challenges, they're still quite valuable to study and to learn because it can enrich what we understand and know about the second level of the canonical Gospels. And in some sense, bleeding into the third. Because I think non-canonical Gospels are Christians' creative ways of wrestling with what the canonical Gospels have shown us. But we'll talk about that more in a bit. The first one we're going to deal with, though, is a guy by the name of Celsus. Now, this is actually written by Origen. So Celsus is a 2nd century Greek philosopher. Origen is writing his book against Celsus about 100 years after Celsus was alive. But apparently, when Celsus was alive, he was a strong opponent to the Christians. We do not have any of Celsus's writings. What we do have Origen's description of his challenges to Christianity and Origen's responses. So this is Celsus, written by Origen about 100 years later. And notice, though, what Celsus is attacking in this quote. He says, in the first place, Celsus accuses Jesus of having, quote, invented his birth from a virgin. Now that's fascinating to me. And upbraids him with being, quote, born in a certain Jewish village of a poor woman of the country who gained her subsistence by spinning. So there is potentially an occupation for Mary. And who was turned out of doors by her husband, a carpenter by trade, because she was convicted of adultery. Okay, now so far, what has it in some sense affirmed of the gospel narratives? Now, it is adding stuff and challenging stuff, but what has it affirmed? He was born of a woman, especially in the context of, now he claims here it's a rumor or a fabrication, but the concept of a virgin birth. So we see from very early on, Celsus in the 2nd century, if he's going to attack Christianity, he sees one of the entry points of attacking Christianity as this apparently robust or strong claim of a virgin birth of Jesus. So it's one of those things where it hasn't been as popular recently, but in the past like 10, 15 years, there's been this almost Christian question, does the virgin birth really matter that much? Do we really need to posit this? Is it something we really need to argue for, or can we just bypass it and just say, yeah, that might have just been one of those miracles that the early people just thought was a miracle, but it wasn't. And one of the things, my major pushback on that is, but it seems like from the very earliest strata of Christian tradition, the virgin birth was essential. It was a central component of their belief, of not just who Jesus was, but in some sense, ultimately, how it is that we are even remotely saved. Because without the virgin birth, there are soteriological ramifications, etc. But Celsus saw, if he's going to attack Christianity, one of their central doctrines to try to take down is the virgin birth. This wasn't an ancillary thing. It wasn't something that was just on the periphery of their beliefs. It was central. Because if Celsus could attack this and, in a sense, expose it for what it is, he would argue, that it would threaten to destabilize the whole Christian belief. We also see, though, that he is affirming that Joseph, or her husband, was a carpenter who was turned out of doors by her husband, a carpenter by trade, because she was convicted of adultery. So even amidst the challenge, you're seeing some affirmations of what the canonical Gospels say. You see how we're reading these? Does this make sense? Moving on. that after being driven away by her husband and wandering about for a time, she disgracefully gave birth to Jesus, an illegitimate child, who having hired himself out as a servant in Egypt on account of his poverty, and having there acquired some miraculous powers on which the Egyptians greatly pride themselves, returned to his own country, highly elated on account of them, and by means of these proclaimed himself a god. Now, what does he affirm in his challenges of the gospel narratives? Say it again. He is a miracle worker, right? We've seen that tradition already in some of the Jewish Roman sources. He's a miracle worker. What else does it affirm? That he was spent time in Egypt. We see that in Matthew's gospel. That whenever Herod starts to kill all of the children under the age of 10 in Bethlehem, Joseph and Mary and Jesus go down for a time in Egypt. That's affirmed as well. Now again, he's using it to attack Jesus, but in the attacks, it's actually affirming some things. It reminds me of the Beelzebub controversy. So Mark chapter 3, Matthew 12, you have the Jewish leaders coming to Jesus and they're like, oh no, no, he's not doing these miracles on account of God. He's actually doing these miracles because he's possessed by Beelzebub. Now the thing that's fascinating about that is, what do they implicitly affirm? They affirm that he's doing miracles that they cannot explain. They cannot explain away. They can't say, actually what he did was, it was a serpent the whole time. He just threw it down and happened to turn into a snake. You know what I mean? Like they're not trying to discount what it is he's done. They're trying to say, it's not what he has done that's the issue. It's where does that power come from? But in their accusation, they implicitly affirm. And that's what you see Kelsus doing here. In his accusations, he's implicitly affirming some of the key details of the gospel narrative. I believe there's one more, no? Yeah. Origen writes, as he elaborates a little bit on the virgin birth, this is fascinating, and saying that, this is Kelsus talking now, when she was pregnant, she was turned out of doors by the carpenter to whom she had been betrothed, as having been guilty of adultery, and that she bore a child to a certain soldier named Panthera. So you actually have Kelsus not just saying, she was pregnant the whole time through adultery. He actually gives the name of the soldier that he suggests actually impregnates her, that causes her disgrace, that causes her eventually the divorcing as the carpenter sends her out of the home, that ultimately leads to Jesus really being, this is basically what Kelsus is saying, is Jesus is a bastard child. He has no father. That he's illegitimate. And so that's why, to hide this illegitimacy, Jesus fabricates a virgin birth. What's interesting is actually later in the Babylonian Talmud, they will also reference Jesus as the son of Panthera, as the son of this certain soldier. Now, at this point, you actually have gospel writers, they think that Panthera is probably a play on words that Kelsus is using, and I'm transliterating, for the word for a virgin, Parthenos. So you can kind of see linguistically how they are parallel. And they say more than likely what he did is he took the word Parthenos for virgin, transformed it into a name that was popular or that would have been common. And then that was his play on words of saying, no, it wasn't a Parthenos that was occurring. It was Panthera. So, linguistically, you see him, though, not only challenging, but I think in some sense this even lets us know how important the virgin birth was to the early church. This was a major doctrine. And frankly, this was something I was talking to somebody recently about. It's a very important thing for Protestants to recover. I'm becoming more and more enamored with Mary. She is a fascinating figure. To be able, in some sense, Mary had to have you have to hear this without the Catholic or the Catholic undertones, because what I'm saying is true. It's just that don't allow your anti-Catholicism to misunderstand what I'm saying. She had to have godlike qualities, in order to actually do what she was asked to do. And what I mean by that is this, is that when Jesus comes, he reveals not just who he is, but he reveals who God the Father is. I mean, we see this in creation, we just don't put it in these terms. But Philippians 2 says on some sense that we are to have the same attitude as Christ Jesus, who, being in the very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped. But what does he do? What does he do in the next movement of that text? What's that? He humbles himself by emptying himself. Kenosis. And so we see Jesus, John 1:18 says that Jesus exegetes God. He is the exegesis of God. So Jesus, the Son, is emptying of himself, is self-giving, and so is the Father. And Mary would have had to have been in order to be a vessel through which God could be birthed. On some sense, in a disposition of self-giving, of emptying of herself in order to receive and then to give again. And to me, honestly, to be in a posture of receptivity that would actually position you to be able to have in your womb the incarnate God, I find to be incredible. I find that to be something that deserves a lot more honor than the Protestants give her. Am I arguing that she is deified? Not even remotely. But I am really sick and tired of her being treated just like any other woman. It's ridiculous. She had the incarnate God in her womb. I mean, that number one, that doesn't happen just on accident. But number two, the type of humility. I mean, my goodness, in the church today, this is one of the things that's super fascinating, but in the church today, we struggle with humility because we don't know what it is. So we think humility is Christian divine depression. That's really what we think humility is. No, humility is not this putting yourself down. It's an emptying of yourself. It's knowing exactly who you are and exactly how God has made you, and in light of that, exactly who he is. That's what humility is. You don't overestimate yourself. You don't underestimate yourself. You know exactly who you are. And that means strengths and weaknesses. You don't put down your strengths if you're truly humble in God. You know exactly what he has done in you and through you. And then you empty yourself, allowing his will to replace yours in such a way that you are able to have the incarnate God dwell in you. In other words, this is where it can sound super Catholic, but I don't care. You need to learn the disposition and the service of Mary in your own life. Because it's a faith, and frankly, it's a human disposition that I think is astounding, especially pre-Holy Spirit. Unbelievable. Unbelievable to me. Startling to me. It's also one of the things where somebody asked me recently, and I don't know if I said it in this class, I think it was in Revelation I was talking about this, but somebody asked me recently about gender. Did I talk about this at all? In here? Was it in here? Where somebody was like, God seems to be always referring to himself as masculine in the Bible. So what does that mean about women? Do they not have value? Did I talk about that in here? Oh yeah, that was their question. And it was from a female. And I was like, man, behind that question is this question. Am I valuable as a female? That was the question. And the bummer is that the church has not done a good job of communicating the value of women, especially in the Protestants, to the point where that shouldn't even be a question that's going through the mind of our people if we were doing a better job communicating the value of women. But I looked at them and I said, oh my gosh, first of all, you need to understand that outside, and I'm not talking about the sun right now, I'm talking in theology proper, any masculine or gender referring to God is a metaphor in this sense. It stretches beyond. God is not contained by a gender. Genders flow from him. He is not categorized by them. When we refer to God as Father, it's so that we have something tangible to interact with him, but it does not mean in that moment that God's saying, yep, I'm a male. Now, when Jesus came to earth, what I said to her was, he had to pick one of the two genders. Those were his two options. One of them was going to have the honor of a third of the Trinity being a part of their gender. But here's what God didn't do. He didn't just appear as a male. He didn't bypass the womb. Instead, as a male, he chose to be birthed through a female. Like, he chose to actually go through the womb of a female. He didn't skip a step. So by him being birthed through a female as a male, he simultaneously affirms both genders. The value of both, the essential reality of both genders for the revelatory power of who he is. I was like, no. Just because God comes as a male does not mean that it denigrates the female whatsoever. Because if he wanted to, in a sense, communicate the lack of value of a female, he didn't have to be born of a female. He could have skipped that. But he chose to come through her womb. So that even though he is appearing in the flesh as male, it is validating the female. Now, do not hear me say this. Do not hear me say that a woman is only found value whenever she is birthing a baby. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is very clearly God is establishing the value by allowing women to be involved in the creation process in a way in which a man never could. So that regardless of whatever that we have found inside of these violent patriarchal societies as well as these arguments of authority, women have value because they get to interact and be united or have the potentiality of being united in a creative act that a male never could be a part of. And Mary is the beacon of this. So the beauty of looking at Mary as an actual female role model is, number one, she screams the value of women from God's perspective. And number two, she becomes a model of which, not just through childbearing, but through whatever it is that God brings your way, that if you've emptied yourself enough, you can embrace his will, and you can even do something as cosmically altering as birthing the incarnate God. Does that make sense? Not to mention the fact I also said, you do understand that Genesis 1, 26 and 1 to 27, I'm speaking to this female, says that the image of God is imprinted upon both male and female. Not just one, is both. Do women have value? Now granted, the church has not done a good job of communicating that. But God has very clearly communicated the value of women. We're just not listening. There's a difference. Does that make sense? The virgin birth for me then is very important also because of whatever it is that Christ assumes he actually is. If he bypassed a womb, we would have a hard time being born again. Like, there are soteriological and transformational ramifications of not believing in a virgin birth. And Celsus understood this, not just because Christians talked about it, but because I think that at that time, the virgin birth concept was taking its development that ultimately comes in the creeds at the beginning of the 4th century. Does that make sense? See why this is a valuable thing to look at. Let's move to the next. The Babylonian Talmud only really has a little bit referencing Jesus, but it does. It says, Yeshu has practiced sorcery and enticed Israel to apostasy. What is the value of this? What does it contribute to the picture of Jesus? Okay, we see a miracle worker theme, which is pretty interesting. At a certain point, whether we're talking Jewish, Roman, and in this one, we're talking the actual Talmud. The miracle worker component of Jesus is pretty firm. It's pretty clear. As a matter of fact, one of the things I find interesting, I was in a lecture or listening to a lecture in the UK, and it was Helen Bond, and she was talking about the historical Jesus. That was her whole lecture. She was writing a book called An Introduction to the Historical Jesus. So she was given kind of like her findings at this point. And one of the things she stated that actually caused some problems in the room was that Jesus, she goes, and the historical Jesus was a miracle worker. And that in the question and answer time, somebody raised their hand and challenged her. They're like, whoa. You mean you affirm miracles? And her response was, from a historical perspective, it's two different questions that you're asking me there. Number one, I'm not saying what I think about miracles. Like, that has nothing to do with what it is we're talking about. Why? Because do I believe in miracles is not a historical question. That's a faith question. And from her perspective, that's what she was saying. She goes, number two, with all of the ways and with the criteria by which we affirm or deny details of the historical Jesus, she said, there is way too much evidence for us to use our modern sensibilities to nullify the fact Jesus was considered a miracle worker. Now, we may think that their miracles, on some sense, were only mere ways of that we could explain away through science today. She goes, but the one thing you cannot say is that Jesus was not, the historical Jesus was not a miracle worker. There's too much evidence that points in the other direction. I mean, my goodness, how many strangers? These are not his friends. It's not like his buddies are writing this line in the Babylonian Talmud. It's his enemies that they're saying, yeah, when it comes to the miracle worker thing, we really can't get around that. It's too clear. It's too robust. It's everywhere. Therefore, even historical Jesus people, which are pretty conservative, ironically, or liberal, depends on how you look at them, in what it is they even accept as a part of Jesus' life, they have to admit that the miracle worker, as far as the external evidence that is affirming the internal evidence of the canonical gospels, that's just too, it's just too strong of a tradition. He's considered a miracle worker. And he entices Israel to apostasy. He wouldn't even make an appearance inside of the Talmud if he wasn't somewhat successful of that last part of that line. If he hadn't had some converts or inroads into Israel, he wouldn't even appear in the Babylonian Talmud. You understand what that's affirming then? It's affirming the success of his ministry on some level, just from the inverse, from the negative perspective. Matter of fact, I'll even say this. Whenever you're wanting to hear most clearly who it is that Jesus actually was, even in the Gospels, pay attention to how his enemies talk about him. That, to me, is really the firm entry point. I mean, whenever you have the enemies explaining what he just said is he claimed to be God, listen to what the enemies are saying. Because if the enemies are affirming something, in some sense, then what we have is a strong foundation by which we can construct something. Okay? Enemies have a different iron in the fire. So they're going to be functioning from a baseline of facts and beliefs. Yeah.
Maybe you can speak to this. I did research on the trials passage one time, and something I read was that one of the categories of blasphemy was false teaching. Mm-hmm. So this, them accusing him of enticing Israel to apostasy,
yeah,
would be in the category of blasphemy, which would appear with their charge, the Sanhedrin's charge.
Absolutely. No, and I would agree with that. As a matter of fact, you also have, what is it? I think it's Babylonian Talmud Sanhedrin. I think it's 97. I think that's right. But where they call the two powers heresy. And you have this dialogue between two rabbis. And one of the things that the one rabbi accuses, actually of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva is accused by, I think it's Rabbi Yeshua or Yeshua. He's accused of elevating David to the level that infringes upon the Shekinah glory, which would have been apostasy. Because matter of fact, they talk about multiple thrones in Daniel's vision. And they're like, well, why is more than one throne there? We only have Yahweh. And Rabbi Akiva says, well, because it's David. And the other rabbi is like, I don't think so. He's like, David can't be on a throne next to God. He's like, that's apostasy. It's like, that's blasphemy. So he says what it is actually it's justice and righteousness. Those are the thrones of God. So in other words, if you make him abstract, then it's not infringing upon him. It's just articulating the qualities of him. And Rabbi Akiva, in the passage, repents. And he says, yeah, you're right. I can't do that. So why that's important is because of what it is that the apostasy would even be in, 50 some odd sections later, that they would be possibly referring to. One of the apostasies that you could, in that context, then affirm of what Jesus would have been teaching is an elevation on some sense of himself to a level that would have been infringing upon the Shekinah glory of God. Now, is that a hop, skip, and a... I mean, I don't think that's a stretch. But yes, what you're describing, definitely, apostasy on some sense would have been, in your Jezebel, Balaam-type categories, and that would be idolatry on some level. And elevating yourself to the level of God is definitely blasphemy. Definitely blasphemy. Because of it's one of the beautiful mysteries that Christ actually reveals is that in an imageless religion, you shall make no images before me, God reveals himself in Christ, and he's referred to in the New Testament as the image of the invisible God. So to claim to be God in the flesh is comparable to idolatry, because you are claiming to be the image of that which by definition should have no image. Yeah. Any other questions or thoughts on that? Okay. Now let's move to the non-canonical gospels. There are actually about 40 non-canonical gospels. I mean, there are not just a couple. Now, we'll talk about some of the dating issues with all those. I'm of the opinion that all non-canonical gospels are mid to late 2nd century and beyond, although that is not what a lot of scholars would like to argue, especially especially dealing with the Gospel of Peter, but especially the Gospel of Thomas. Okay, I'm not touching anything. All right, is that falling out? Is that the problem? Gosh, I'm not. Am I? Okay. So what I want to do is I want us to read several of these non-canonical gospels so that, number one, I want to give you the top three most popular. So it'll be the infancy Gospel of Thomas, which is different than the Gospel of Thomas, but the infancy Gospel of Thomas, which we'll look at first, that describes Jesus from the ages of 5 and it ends with him at the age of 12. Then we'll look at the Gospel of Peter, which is a fascinating gospel, of which we have one incomplete manuscript, but we'll talk about that. And then the Gospel of Thomas itself. So the infancy Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Peter, and then the Gospel of Thomas itself. These are the three most prominent of the non-canonical gospels. Although, like I said, there's about 40. But you're going to hear in scholarly discussions stuff about these three the most. And the beautiful thing about reading them is that on some level we can see how they are quite different from the canonical gospels. And yet, also, whenever you read them, you can understand the value of looking at them and studying them and, in a sense, knowing what they're about. In other words, we're not just talking about a bunch of scary boogeymen when we're going through these. Do I think that they should hold a significant authority in the church? No. But do I think that, does that mean that they're not valuable to study? No. Something doesn't have to have significant authority in order for it to be an important study to engage. Okay? So, infancy Gospel of Thomas. Let's just go ahead and look at some of the interesting contrasts of the miracles that Jesus does here as opposed to in the gospel itself. Man, wish that... No. Sorry, I guess I'll just have to trust me on those words. All right. This is infancy Gospel of Thomas, chapter 1, verses 1 through 5. When the boy Jesus was 5 years old, he was playing at the ford of a rushing stream, and he gathered the disturbed water into pools and made them pure and excellent, commanding them by the character of his word alone and not by means of a deed. Then, taking soft clay from the mud, he formed 12 sparrows. It was the Sabbath. Uh-oh. You catch what? Like, if you've read the canonical gospels and you see that in a non-canonical gospel, what are you thinking? You see, it was the Sabbath. What are you thinking? Every time Sabbath is invoked in the canonical gospels, what ends up happening? Conflict, controversy, right? Somebody gets upset. It was the Sabbath when he did these things, and many children were with him, witnesses. And a certain Jew, seeing the boy Jesus with the other children doing these things, went to his father Joseph and falsely accused the boy Jesus, saying that on the Sabbath he made clay, which is not lawful, and fashioned 12 sparrows. And Joseph came and rebuked Jesus, saying, "Why are you doing these things on the Sabbath?" But Jesus, clapping his hands, commanded the birds with a shout in front of everyone and said, "Go, take flight and remember me, living ones." And the sparrows, taking flight, went away squawking. When the Pharisees saw this, he was amazed and reported it all to his friends. Okay, this is different. Why? What is different about this? Compare it to the canonical gospels. What's different? Yeah. Okay, number one, we never see him as a child outside of Luke's gospel, but he was 12 then, right? So this is different because you're going like, huh, this is little Jesus. This is my son Robert at the age of Jesus. Lord, help me. Kidding. He's delightful. Yes.
In the canonical gospels, you never see Jesus like kind of flippantly using miracles like the
Okay, now that's something that I find fascinating. There is a weirdness with the utilization of the miracles in this context, is there not? It's not just flippant, it's very self-serving. There's almost an arrogance behind this miracle, where he's just messing around and he makes all these, you know, nice little things, which technically, according to the laws of the land at the time, that would have been illegal what he did. That's why I think it's interesting they say falsely accused. It's only falsely accused if you read the later canonical gospels into this. But no, I mean, it actually was a correct accusation according to the laws of the land. You could not make clay. And that's what he did by getting the water and the mud and putting them together and then fashioning. I mean, that's what happened. So as a way of basically saying, like, you don't own me, he's like, and fly away. Now, we do have the closest that we have to this is a man with a shriveled hand inside of a synagogue on the Sabbath day. In order that you know that I am the Son of Man, and he heals the guy's hand, that I am the Lord of the Sabbath, heals his hand. The difference is this. That miracle did what? It pierced the legalism with compassion towards someone that was broken. You see what I mean? Whereas this one, I mean, I guess you could, if, you know, if you're PETA, I guess you're really excited about this because birds get life. But the compassion that's piercing this is different. It seems to be more self-serving. It reminds me of, honestly, this reminds me of more of like one of the temptations that Satan offers Jesus in the wilderness. Turn these rocks into bread and eat. You know, self-serving miracle. Use your miracles to satisfy yourself. And Jesus doesn't seem to be interested in that. Now, part of the thing I find interesting about this, though, and even fascinating, one of the reasons why I'm really fascinated by the infancy gospel of Thomas is I do want to know what it was like for Jesus to be a child. And I think that it is actually, some sense, beautiful that we even get to ask that question of the incarnate God. What was he like as a child? I mean, we know he never sinned, but did he at times, you know, did Mary perceive him as back talking? Did she have to instruct him? Is back talking a sin, or is it something that with gentle correction, as long as you're responding? I mean, and even in some sense, even kind of starts to really challenge what it is that even, what is a sin? And if Jesus was sinless, then what is it about children that they do or don't do that we actually could categorize as a sin? Or is it that we as adults are superimposing our depths of understanding of sin onto the children and that's what we think that they're doing, when in reality they're not? That is actually one of the things that I'm reminded consistently whenever I'm dealing with Robert. I'm saying that right now because Robert's, you know, he didn't really have terrible twos. He's delayed them until the fours. But deep down in his heart, whenever I'm talking to him, whenever he disobeys, I can see in his eyes he longs to obey. There's a longing in his heart where he doesn't want to be in trouble. He wants to do what is right. And in reality, a lot of the things that Robert is doing is because he has emotions that are deep down inside of him, and he doesn't know when they start to surface, he doesn't know what to do with them. And so whenever it gets up to here, his response is to act out in different ways. And so what I'm learning is, as a dad, the number one thing we have to do as parents is to figure out how to listen to the heart of our children better than they know, and then to teach them how to listen to their own heart so that they don't need to act out in these ways, so that they don't need to. They actually, whenever that emotion starts to bubble, they can say, I know what this is, and I know how to deal with this. And I've been talking to my daughter about this a lot, talking to Paige. I'm going, listen, hey, you don't need to fight for yourself. In our family, if you need something, here's what you need to do. Just ask. If you say, hey, Dad, I just need some time alone. That's cool, girl. You know, just go back in your room and just, you know, close the door and just chill. It's fine. She's an introvert, which is hard being in a house full of six and a very wide open floor plan when you're an introvert and you don't even know it because you're... She also loves people, so she has a constant internal war. I want to be near people, but oh my gosh, I need to be alone. Like, and so, but you know, there's times I was like, hey, but if you need to just hang out with mom or dad for a little bit, you're like, hey, I just need to like just chill with you guys, do nothing and just play one-on-one. Just ask. And one of the things that Paige would do, though, is we would find that Paige would, she would embellish things. Whenever she needed this intention, this attention, this desire to be close to us, she would fabricate things. Or whenever she would get caught doing something she had done wrong, her initial response was to deceive. And one of the things I told her, I was like, honey, always rely on the truth. Just always rely on the truth. But what you need to know is why you're even doing this thing to begin with. It's because there's something deep down here that really you're trying to communicate, and it comes out like this. So recently, the other day, I was joking with her. I was saying something to her like, oh, come on, Paige. I think she goes, Dad, I've taken your advice. I'm just relying on the truth. I was like, that's my girl correcting her dad. I'm like, this is grand. The whole point is, what was it like for Mary and Joseph to be parenting the incarnate God? I mean, to help the incarnate God on some sense discover the stirrings that are deep in his heart. I mean, if Jesus was truly human, there's a part of him that had to go through the awkward phase of junior high. Who am I? Messiah? Like, I mean, Luke's gospel does say Jesus grows in stature and in wisdom. Let that sink in for a moment. We have a God that loves us so much, that's willing to empty himself so thoroughly, that even though he is limitless in his omniscience and creative ability, he actually willfully puts himself in a position where he has to learn wisdom. That's ridiculous. Ridiculously beautiful. But honestly, it's like, it's beyond what words can even approach, what even our best imaginative attempts can even capture. So I actually find the infancy gospel of Thomas a fascinating attempt at somebody bold enough to utilize their imagination of wrestling with the humanity of Christ as a child onto a document. Do I think it's authoritative? No. But do I find it very, very fascinating and even important for me to wrestle with what was it like as Jesus as a child? Absolutely. Absolutely. But I mean, it is. Sometimes we can create Jesus in our own image once we look at him like this, and that's what you see in this next section. Did it change? Yes, it did. Good. Okay, this is Infancy Gospel of Thomas 3:1 through 4:3. While Jesus was going from there with his father Joseph, a child running tore into his shoulder. Boof, just nailed him. And Jesus said to him, "You shall no longer go our way." And he instantly died. Oh, well, that's okay. At once, the people, seeing that he was dead, cried out and said, "Where was this boy born that his word becomes a deed?" Now, that sounds interesting. Where was this boy born? What does that remind you of? We've talked about it in here before. Yeah, remember John 7, where they were like, oh, but we know where this one is born. He can't be the Messiah. That's, again, you see the canonical gospel being read back into the minds of the people as a way of pointing towards Jesus' identity. Where was this boy born that his word becomes a deed? And when they saw what had happened, the parents of the dead boy blamed his father Joseph, saying, "Because you have this boy, you cannot live with us in this village. Does Jesus' identity cause problems for his family where they live? If you wish to be here, teach him to bless and not to curse." And Joseph said to Jesus, why do you do such things? They suffer and hate us. And the boy said to Joseph, "If the words of my father were not wise, he would not know how to instruct children." Why? You're five. Why do you talk like that? And again he said, "If these were children of the bridal chamber, they would not receive curses. These people shall receive their punishment." I'm sorry, I shouldn't laugh at that. You see a dissonance in the Jesus of the canonical Gospels and the Jesus of the infancy Gospels of Thomas because in our imagination, we are tempted at times to create Jesus in our own image. I mean, if I were God, you know what I'd do? I'd settle all the scores. You see that feel? What's fascinating is whenever Jesus comes into man, like to be a man, whenever he grows in stature and wisdom, you actually see enhancing a compassion as opposed to a vindictiveness. Instantly, the ones accusing him were blinded. Jesus is like, and you're done, and you're done. Like, he's just wiping them out. But Joseph became angry and took hold of Jesus' ear and pulled hard. Love that. Get over here, you little snot. Quit zapping people. And Jesus said to him, it is enough for you to seek me and to find me. You have acted foolishly. I mean, it does affirm like the sage Jesus, but not. It's a little weird when he comes like out of the womb speaking in Proverbs, you know. But whenever you try to think of Jesus as a child, how much of yourself do you see? You know what I mean? You know, it's like, how much does Jesus actually share in our struggles as humanity? I mean, Hebrews talks about it in kind of a we've transformed it into a more of a mystical way. You know, he has all the same sufferings that we experience. The temptations, he's experienced them too. And I agree with that 100%. I just don't like the way we've engaged it. Like, I want to know how much Jesus can relate to my story. Because, I mean, I think it's fascinating here how he's zapping everybody. But, for example, in the ancient world, especially in other cultures, children were preyed upon pretty persistently. And when I mean preyed upon, I mean sexual abuse was not uncommon. So let's really put flesh on Jesus and ask the question, is it possible that somebody molested the Son of God? That's a little different question of how much he intersects with your story than just merely him getting mad and zapping people dead. We need to exercise our imaginations of asking the question, growing up, living on this world, how much of my story did Jesus actually encounter? Because I'll tell you this, if it was not possible for the Son of God to be molested, he was not fully human. He was not. You see why that's in... Now, I know that comes with a little bit of a heavier load. That's kind of the point. If he was not tempted at times... Now, I'm not saying that if he was not tempted to use his powers in a self-serving, vindictive way, he was not fully human. I mean, even just as a father, you have more power than your children until a certain age. And at times, they can push you to a limit where you can be tempted to use your power in a vindictive way to preserve yourself. That temptation is real. My goodness, even in the dorms, this happens. You know, some of you, the way that you have, you know, received responsibilities and maybe even honors on campus, maybe even tempted at times in the dorms when an argument arises to use that against people as a weapon to preserve yourself. Well, I mean, look at the internship I've got. What have you gotten? Do you know who my dad is? Do you know who my mom is? If Jesus wasn't ever tempted in these ways, he wasn't human. And there's a part of the infancy gospels that they are funny, but also startling, because what they do is they do present a contrast with the adult Jesus. But you look in the mirror of it and you see yourself pretty clearly. Kind of like in this next one. This one's a little better, still self-serving a bit, but... And again, after many days, Jesus was playing with other children on a certain roof of an upstairs room. And one of the children fell and died. Okay. The other children, seeing this, went to their homes, and they left Jesus alone. They're like, oh, shoot, he's dead. Everybody run! You know, it's like, Sandlot, scatter! The parents of the dead child came and accused Jesus. I mean, they had a reason to accuse him. Did we read the previous passage? And you're dead, and you're blind, and they're like, he's dead, and they're like, you did it! And they said, you knocked down our child like you did that other one. But Jesus said, I didn't knock him down. Sounds like a child to me. And while they were raging and shouting, Jesus came down from the roof and stood beside the body and cried out in a loud voice saying, Zena, Zena, for this was his name, Rise and say if I knocked you down. Prove that I am not a liar. And he rose and said, no, Lord, didn't do it. Didn't do it. And Jesus was like, see? When they saw, they were amazed. And the parents of the children praised God for these wonders. It's a little different than Lazarus come forth from the grave. You know what I mean? I mean, there is a testimony factor, but not really a self-serving justification. I mean, it reminds me of the contrast, really, of the trials with Pilate. Jesus refused to even give himself a defense. Aren't you going to say something? No, I'm good. Why not? Don't you want to defend yourself? I've done everything in public. You don't need to guess what I'm about or what I taught. Go ask anybody. No, I'm not going to defend myself. I don't need to. So like a lamb to the slaughter, he was silent. There is a that part of the Pontius Pilate trial always gets me, because I'm like, ugh, I always want to defend myself. Always. It reminds, like, honestly, my heart is closer to this in the infancy gospel of Thomas than it is with his interaction with Pontius Pilate. I mean, if I could call somebody back from the dead and they could be a testimony for me just to prove that I was innocent, I would. Why? Because I'm arrogant and proud. Because I want to be perceived a certain way. It's much different in the canonical gospels, where he does benevolent miracles and then commands them not to tell. As opposed to here doing this very public miracle and being like, yeah, Zeno, tell him. You got my back. It's different. And in the contrast, you're able to see clearly, number one, who the canonical gospels show Jesus to be, and number two, who you are not in the contrasts. Are these gospels canonical? No. Should they be read authoritatively? No. Are they valuable? Most definitely. I mean, we will treat them as such. All right, love you guys. See you in the morning. Gospel of Peter.